Hello, I'm Molly Adams, and this is YouthCast. A new year usually means a new beginning. It's time to look back, figure out what worked and what didn't, and then move on with your life. But obviously there are some events and histories that you can't abandon so easily. Mara Kumagai Fink's family has that kind of history. During World War II, since her family was of Japanese descent, they were moved from their homes in the Pacific Northwest to internment camps in the desert of California. In the years that they lived there, they lost their businesses, their connections to home, and their sense of self. Japanese American Granddaughter Questions Internment is a powerful report from Minnesota Public Radio News' Youth Radio series. It's about the histories that we inherit from our families and the impossibility of ever, quote-unquote, getting over a physical and emotional upheaval. After you hear this story, please stick around for a conversation between myself and Mara. She told me about the building of this story, the effects of reparations for her family, and the work she's continuing to do to educate people about the Japanese-American internment. Here is Japanese-American Granddaughter Questions Internment by Mara Kumagai Fink for NPR News' Youth Radio series.
Since I was in grade school, I've known that my Grandma Kay was forced to live in an internment camp during World War II. Her family was taken from their strawberry farm on Bainbridge Island, Washington, and lived in army barracks in the desert. But whenever I ask her about it, she tells me it wasn't that big of a deal.
Actually, camp life, it's an experience, but I don't think it hurt it. I think it hurt a lot of people. Most of all, it hurt financially. But being as young as I was in my early 20s didn't bother me at all. It's something you endure, and it's fine.
How could living in desert camps with barbed wire and guards with guns be fine? I wanted to see for myself. My grandma's memory is not what it once was, and so I took her younger sister with me to the internment camp in California where her family was sent during the war.
So now we're at Manzanar, and you can hear the wind probably cutting across the desert, and there are the beautiful Sierra Nevada mountains in the background, but here it's really hot. It's 102 degrees and sunny.
So do you recognize it?
Are you kidding? No, because there's more sagebrush now.
Auntie Matsu is one of my grandma's younger sisters. She was 14 when her family left Bainbridge Island and came here. My aunt's been back to Manzanar before. She described the barracks where she and her brother and sisters stayed with their mom.
They're just open rooms, and you just have one cot after another. And so you have to have a little privacy, so that's why you took a bedspread and put it up at one end of the apartment so that you could change your clothes.
Changing clothes was only one of the challenges. Temperatures range from over 100 degrees in the summer to below freezing in the winter. Frequent dust storms coated the insides of the barracks with a fine layer of grime. How could you not be mad? Like, if I had to live in this temperature for the summer and then be freezing cold in the winter, I would just be mad about having to live here regardless of whether I was stuck here or not.
We had no choice, so we had to just accept it. We had no choice. We couldn't go anyplace else. They didn't allow us to go anyplace else. So what could we do?
Well,
we can't run out of here.
Well, I know, but did you ever feel mad?
Oh, of course. But it was just one of those times of life that we had to just accept it as it was.
Matsu's father, my great-grandfather, was not in the camp with them. Just before the family was evacuated, the FBI arrested my great-grandfather, alleging he sent a small amount of money and comfort bags to the Japanese soldiers and possessed sticks of dynamite. The dynamite part was true. He needed it to clear stumps from the strawberry fields. The donations to Japanese soldiers was not. Matsu remembers going to visit her father at the immigration center in Seattle.
You see your dad behind bars, and that was just such a terrible feeling. And I just stood there, and I just cried, so I couldn't even talk to my dad. I was crying so hard. And then, of course, we didn't see our dad until a good year after that.
That was my grandma's family story. My grandpa's family was also in camp. 35 years after coming to America, they had saved enough money to buy a greenhouse in Seattle. When the government put them in camp, they lost everything. My grandpa died before I was born, but my Uncle Ross, my grandpa's youngest brother, is still alive. Ross was 9 when his family was moved into horse stables at the Pinedale Assembly Center in California, and then transferred to 2 other camps in Northern California and Idaho.
I remember when we went out to play football. We were playing by the fence, and the ball rolled to the fence, toward the fence, and a guard up there in the tower says, "Stop or I'll shoot." I said, "Yes, sir." And then we ran, and to this day, I don't know if we ever retrieved that football or not.
While Ross was in the camps, my grandpa was in his 20s and serving in the armed forces. My grandpa's job was to recruit Japanese Americans from inside the camps for the Military Intelligence Service. While my grandpa was able to go in and out of the camps recruiting soldiers, his family remained locked up by the country he worked for. After the war was over, they returned to find that people had shattered the windows of their greenhouse. His family couldn't keep up with their mortgage while in camp, so they walked away and started over in Minnesota. Ross says he wasn't angry while he was a 9-year-old in camp.
Not till I got much older did I feel anger. And it took a good part of my life, I think, that they put me in there for 4 years. I missed a lot, particularly schooling. And I think I got out and I was in the 8th grade. And I had to work twice as hard. There was many, many evenings of crying and trying to catch up. I think I'm still crying.
My grandma's family was much luckier. Neighbors had taken care of their land. But my grandma's youngest sister, Shima, found that picking up where she left off wasn't easy. She tried to rejoin the Brownie troop she had been in before the war, but the leader claimed she'd fallen too far behind.
Well, then the next thing I wanted to do was join another group. Well, I found out I couldn't join because I was Japanese. And I went to bed that night in tears because I couldn't join anything.
That feeling of rejection was experienced many more times by Shima and her sisters, and they still tell me that they're not angry. But after talking with them, I realize now that they didn't hold on to their outrage because they couldn't. They had to move on with their lives. But when I read about an effort in Texas to revise textbooks to say that the internment wasn't racially motivated, I'm concerned. As a Japanese American granddaughter, I want to make sure that what my family experienced as American citizens isn't forgotten. For NPR News Youth Radio Series, I'm Mara Kumagai-Fink.
That was Japanese American Granddaughter Questions Internment by Mara Kumagai-Fink for NPR News' Youth Radio Series. I called Mara right after finals ended at her school, St. Olaf College in Northfield, Minnesota. With this piece, how did you research this story outside of asking your family questions?
I knew that my grandma was in camp when I was younger, but I didn't know, a lot of the details of it because she wouldn't talk about it. So I knew it wasn't a good place to be, and that's about it. And so when I was doing all this stuff this summer, I was working at an organization in Portland that talked about the Japanese American experience from Portland.
In Portland, Oregon?
Yeah, in Portland, Oregon. Mm-hmm. And then I was visiting all these other camps. I visited each of the camps that my family was in.
Mm-hmm.
So that was a really eye-opening experience for me, I think, just because at some of the camps there were other camp survivors. Like, we went during pilgrimages, and so there were other camp people who had been in camp with my family who knew them. And I just learned so much more from actually being there. And I think the fact that I was coming from Portland and then taking these weekend trips to the desert where these camps were, I could really understand what a shock it was, because, you know, Portland is, you know, green
Stumptown.
And rainy and yeah. lush. And then you go to the desert and it's just barren and desolate. And so, I don't know.
So does your Aunt Matsu, does she live in that area? Or how did you make that connection? Because that's pretty amazing to be at the camp with her.
Yeah, she lives in Seattle. All my grandma's sisters live in Seattle now. And I had asked her a while back if she would be okay going with me because I knew my grandma wouldn't want to go. And then she kind of didn't respond for a long time, and I was like, okay, well, I guess we're not going to go. And then I was out there working, and then one of the other cousins, I was originally going to go with two of my grandma's sisters, and then some health problems kept them from going, but they were like, oh, we're going to go to Manzanar. Do you want to come? So I ended up going with my Aunt Matsu and her, I guess it would be her niece.
Complicated family.
Yeah, so it was three generations of mm-hmm. us that were there, which is really cool.
I think personal histories in the U.S. is always, you know, like you know, sometimes you know more or you know less about your personal history. Like I always say, I remember in the public schools did their units on the Holocaust in seventh grade, where I had like been aware of all of the atrocities since second grade. Because of Sunday school. And with the Japanese internment, it must get even more frustrating because you'll meet full-blown adults who have never heard of this.
I think that was always kind of a frustration for me growing up, that no one ever knew about it or really talked about it in school. So I'd have to be the one who would bring it up in my classes. And a lot of times my teachers would say, yeah, well, you know, you can come and talk about it, or you can bring your grandma in and talk about it. But I think that if I wasn't in the class, it wouldn't have gotten talked about.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's part of the reason why I'm working on this project, this other side project that I started last summer, to create an educational program in Minnesota in a couple of school districts about the internment.
Did that like official apology from the U.S. mean anything to your family?
Well, I don't really want to speak for them.
Yeah.
But I know that when I asked them about it, they would say, like, one of my grandma's sisters said, you know, for everything that they put us through, $20,000 was nothing. I mean,
so your family got $20,000?
Yeah, they got reparation payment.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, by that time, a lot of the people who had been in camp had died off.
Mm-hmm.
So they didn't get anything. Like Uncle Ross said, I don't know if anything that they could have paid them would give them back those, you know, 4 years or however long they spent in those camps.
And especially to hear about the economic devastation to the families, it's like that money doesn't mean anything 50 years later when we needed it right afterwards.
Right, when they lost everything.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Do you think that there ever really will be any healing from it? Because it's also clearly still, like, it's something that you are still processing, and it's not part of your direct personal experience.
I think that the fact, like, all my great aunts out there, like Auntie Matsu and Auntie Shima, they talk about it, and they go to schools and talk about it. And I think having people know about it, it seems like, is really important to their healing process. But with my grandma, I don't know that she's allowed any healing to happen. I mean, I've always felt like when I talk to her, she just doesn't think about it. And she's really good at just not letting it into her thoughts, maybe. She won't even talk about it. So I don't know if she's ever processed through any of it at all.
Yeah, no, and you get that. It's like, no, it was all fine. Stop asking me about it.
Yeah, and she does that about everything in her life that's been hard.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah.
Well, great. I think this is a really great piece, and it definitely continues the narrative and keeps people talking about it. And I think it's some really cool reporting, and I'm glad to see that you're continuing that work through direct education.
Thanks so much.
You're welcome. And thank you for talking with me. I hope you had a happy holiday time. this month if you celebrate any of these holidays.
Thank you.
And a Happy New Year to you as well.
Thanks. Happy New Year to you too.
So, thanks again to Mara for talking to me on the phone, and a very Happy New Year from YouthCast, a project of Generation PRX. Generation PRX is a website devoted to supporting, connecting, and distributing youth-produced audio. Check it out at generationprx.org. If you have some free time over these holidays, spend it on the internet, specifically at youthcast.org, where you can hear old episodes, read exclusive interviews, and see and hear stories told through audio and video. You can also join us on Facebook at facebook.com/youthcast. We'll talk to you in 2011. Bye.